Georgie Crawford, you're listening to the Good Glow podcast. Throughout my treatment for breast cancer, I've realised the importance of self-care. Whether it's a trip to the gym, a checkup with your GP, or even a 5-minute meditation, the time has come for us to put ourselves higher on our own to-do list. I'll speak to people who remind us to take better care of ourselves. And what better way to take care of ourselves than to understand more about our bodies? This series, I've teamed up with Fitbit. Fitbit allows you to get to know yourself better and understand your health with insights that are unique to you. As I always say, knowledge is power, and Fitbit provides data about your health and well-being to help empower and support you in leading a balanced and healthy lifestyle. I'm so happy to have Fitbit on board, as my Fitbit helps keep me focused and on track with my goals and training. Being partnered with Fitbit is inspiring, as they're encouraging everyone to make positive changes, and I hope this podcast does too. Welcome to the Good Glow podcast with Jamie Crawford.
Hello.
This is so weird. Since I started this podcast last December, I often do Q&As on Instagram, and I always ask people who they want to hear on the podcast, and everybody always says you. Mm. It's season 4 now, and I suppose I just wanted to wait for an appropriate time for us to have this conversation, and this seems like the most appropriate time for me anyway. We're recording this on Thursday the 10th of October, and it was 2 years ago today that I was told I had breast cancer.
Mm. That was a pretty dark day in our lives.
Let's go back then to the start of when I was diagnosed. So we had just bought a house, we just moved, you just started a new job, and we just had Pia. So things were kind of, had worked out really well for us.
Yeah, things were all going pretty well. I remember one night specifically, we had just moved into the house, and I, it was kind of like our dream home. And I know you've referenced that before, and we, I remember pulling up at the driveway and you were standing at the window. So like, we live, for everyone listening, we live in a bungalow, and it's kind of, the front of the bungalow is kind of raised up. So as you drive in, you look up, there was Georgie kind of standing at the window with our little baby kind of waving in the window. And I remember parking that night and kind of reversing back and looking up at you and thinking, this is what living is about. Life has finally come, you know, all the way around, and I'm so happy. And I literally think about 4 days later, you found the lump in your breast. And, it's mad to go from that kind of euphoric feeling of like, yes, we have our dream home, I have my baby, my wife, you know, everyone's really happy. I've just started, a new business with a friend of mine. Things were all just, everything was just going in our direction. And then bang, like a sledgehammer. It was just sort of taken away from us.
That night that I found the lump, you did the night feed, because I said to you going to bed that Wednesday night that I was really tired, and Pia was on bottles at this point, so we were kind of sharing the night feeds. So you did the night feed, and it was about 1:30, and you were putting Pia back into her bed, and that is when I woke up and my hand fell against my chest, and I found the lump. Do you remember that moment?
I remember putting her back into bed awkwardly and her kind of waking up, and then you sitting upright and sort of twisting and leaning over and then going, and you're, Jamie, I have a lump in my breast. And I kind of remember going, oh, don't worry about it. That's probably nothing. And then you grabbing my hand and like my index finger and my middle finger and like pushing them onto the lump really hard. And that's when I kind of went, I don't think I've ever said this to you, but that's when I kind of went, that's not nothing. I started to get a bit shaky then. That's what I remember.
Yeah, because you
then were like, come outside, we need to sit in the lounge, we need to talk about this. Yeah. I remember my head was just in my pillow and I was like, I can't move, I can't believe this is happening to me, oh my God, oh my God. And you were like, come on, get out of bed, we have to sit down. So we went out to the lounge, we sat down. We kind of just decided that we'd go to the GP the next morning and then you sent me back to bed, but you stayed up for a couple of hours.
Yeah, I stayed up. I remember sort of Googling what it could be. So for those, you know, you obviously know me, but like I go to Logic as my first port of call for pretty much everything. And I was like, what could this logically be? You're breastfeeding, you have a lump, it's, you know, you've suddenly stopped breastfeeding or you slow down very quickly, you know, it's potential like blocked milk ducts. I remember your breasts were sore, you know, obviously because your body was changing or adapting to coming off breastfeeding and doing combination feeding or bottle feeding. So I remember just going in my head to Logic straight away and going, okay, well, what apart from cancer could this be? And does it feel or does it look like those things? And going into Dr. Google, which is a stupid thing for anyone to do, but at that time when you're panicking, that's what you do, and it actually sends you into a bigger panic. And yeah, I just remember going, okay, well, this could be these things or it could be those things, but look, it's most likely not cancer. So we go to bed. I think that the thing I found that it would most likely be was a fibroadenoma, I think it was called. And then when we went to the GP the next day, she said that, you know, it could be that. But you should probably get it checked anyway.
So the Friday came then. The Thursday we went to the GP and then we thought we might have to wait a couple of weeks to get into a breast clinic. But I just rang every hospital in Dublin, got an appointment for Bowman the next day. And that was the night that I was due to go to the Radio Awards. Mm. So I was going off for the night and you were going to stay with Pia. So the appointment was at 9:30. We thought we'd be out the door by 10:30 with news that it was a cyst. But
yeah,
I remember when we got to that private hospital in Bowman Private, I asked if you could come in for the ultrasound, but the room was too small and the radiologist just wanted to concentrate on her job and said she only ever has the patient in the room. Mm. So I just went off.
And at that time, I wasn't really that worried because, again, I was sticking with Logic and what the thing would most likely be, that it would just show up as a cyst or one of these fibroadenoma things or, you know. And I remember you going in by yourself and then I remember you being in there for ages. And then coming out and you were wearing the kind of hospital gown, obviously covering your top. And you turned to the right to look at me and you like shook your head and then went left and went off down with the radiologist. And that's when I went, oh, shit. Just part of me, because, you know, what I've been through with my dad and being very familiar with the kind of system in hospitals around that sort of stuff. Like my dad had only died a year previous. And I remember just seeing you walk down the hallway with her. And I was like, they are looking for something now. This isn't just something that they can easily identify on a scan. They're actually looking for something else. And that's when I started to get really worried.
So I went then for a mammogram and a biopsy and we just went home that day. I think everyone was trying to convince me to still go to the Radio Awards, but I was like, no, I just want to be with Pia. The next day was that night that I talk about all the time of collapsing onto the ground in the hall after Googling something. And I think nothing has been as bad ever since that night, even being told I had cancer. Like that was the moment that I thought I was going to die.
Yeah, I think that was the worst night for me because we still didn't really know what it was, but we had our suspicions. And you, I think, had Googled a type of biopsy that you thought was done on you, which I think, if I remember correctly, is called a punch hole biopsy. I remember you just collapsing on the floor in the hall and like just there was like tears, obviously you were crying, but like, you know, it was you know, your nose is running. It was just like awful to see in that state, and that just freaked me out, and I got really worried then. And I remember, you know, as I do, I tend, you know, myself and my sister are very close, so I called her from the back garden because I didn't want you to hear me being panicky. And I went out the back and slid the door, and I'll never forget it. So I was standing on that little bit of grass that we have just outside the utility room, staring in the window. And so and it's basically saying, this is cancer, Julie. It has to be like, that's when I accepted it, that I knew what it was. Having read a lot more about the types of tests they do, there was only one thing they were looking for. They were nothing, not looking for absolutely anything. There's nothing else they were looking for. So I knew then it was cancer. And that would be confirmed. The likelihood of it not being cancer was tiny because of the tests that they'd done. So I remember saying to Julie, she has cancer, she has cancer. And Julie's like, no, you know, it's not cancer. And all I remember saying to Julie is, how am I going to raise a one-year-old on my own? Because that's your default mode, is that you go to somewhere like that in your mind, is that you have cancer, you're going to die. But that's not actually the case now. You know, maybe many years ago it was, but, you know, it's not now.
It's, I didn't know that that's what you said to Julie that night.
Yeah, I just freaked. So that was the only time I panicked, and I couldn't get control of you. And I don't sound like a freak when I say that, but like normally I can get you under control and I can calm you down and I can talk to you. And I just couldn't do it that night. And the reason I made the call to Julie is like, I need you up here. I need other people to help me. So I called Julie and I called your mum. And they both came up, and I remember they, you know, sat on that. I just remember they both sat either side of you on the couch, like holding you, one arm around your back and one arm around your waist. And they were just holding you, and you were like, your head was like between your knees. And I remember just standing up, like just standing there, like kind of biting my nails as I do, just being absolutely freaked.
Yeah, I don't think anything has been as hard since that night.
Yeah.
I'll never forget it.
Yeah.
So then we got through the next couple of days anyway, and then on the Tuesday morning, I think you were in work. I got a phone call to say to come in at 4:30 for the results, and they asked me to bring someone with me.
Yeah.
So we went in, met Professor Arnie Hill, and we were brought into the room and told I had cancer, but I feel like everything started to improve from that point. Arnie Hill was so reassuring and spoke about all the people that get diagnosed with breast cancer and go on to get better and have children. And he spoke to us a lot about the survivors, and that meant so much to us. But they did want to find out if the cancer had spread. And luckily, it hadn't. We found that out the following week.
But going back to that day that we were called in, I remember picking you up. I think I was in work that morning. I remember picking you up and looking out the back door, the sliding doors, and there was one single magpie sitting there. And one magpie on its own has always been a sign of bad luck. And I remember looking at that going, oh shit. And then as we were going to Beaumont, we were turning right at the step in, and where the old guard station was, there was a magpie sitting on the window ledge there as well. And I remember just going, this is a sign that this is good,
that this was going on.
I just, in my head, I was like, this is just like, I knew what it was. I knew it was like, I just knew it was cancer. But like, that to me was like, this is definitely a sign that this is not good news. Didn't know the extent of the news. That was what I suppose I was really worried about at that point.
And did you feel reassured then after we were told?
Yeah, that was the start. The not knowing is always the worst part. Once you know, then, I don't know, for me, I can visualize an action plan and I can start to formulate my own sort of management plan of what I'm going to do and how I'm going to handle it once I have the information. But if you know information, you just can't do that. And that's where you're sort of in limbo, just waiting on other people and waiting on decisions and things like that to be made. So yeah, the drive in of not knowing exactly what it was or whether it spread. But he was, you know, Arnie Hill's incredibly he was incredibly reassuring, and he was very you know, took a lot of time to explain it and talk about it. And I think the fact that he said, you know, may not have been there for only a couple of weeks, and he seems to have caught it early, and that's a big thing, and you know, they just need to check if it hadn't spread, which is back to your earlier point.
And were you surprised by how I took the news, or?
Yeah, I think you definitely took it. I think you'd accepted it at that point, though, that you kind of knew what it was yourself deep down. You know, you cried, but you weren't, there was no, you were never as upset as you were that Saturday night when you fell on the floor. Mm.
Going to see Dr. Morris then, and kind of the reality of the treatment, the 5 months of chemo, 4 weeks of radiotherapy. Like, I was totally convinced they'd just give me chemo once because the cancer hadn't spread. Mm. But when he said 5 months of chemotherapy, I remember thinking, oh, like, this is proper cancer. Like, I am going to look like a cancer patient.
Yeah. Well, I remember you asking him, would you lose your hair? And him saying, well, yeah, you would. And then sliding that box of tissues over the table and you crying. And I think that, yeah, if I was to, second place of upset was that time. So first time was the Saturday on the floor, and then you were pretty upset when you found out you were going to lose your hair.
I found it really difficult to tell people that. Like, I think I was fine with the losing my hair myself, because I was like, you know, I wasn't that into hair,
you're not
vain, makeup,
yeah,
and da-da-da-da. So I didn't really mind, but I found it really hard to tell my mum and your mum and our families that I was going to lose my hair. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know. And I think, I don't know if this is politically correct to say, but I think older people find that a worse thing than maybe younger people these days, because, you know, you see lots of people go around with really short hair, and it's a fashion statement.
Mm. How did you feel then when they told me that I'd need 5 months of chemo?
I kind of knew that you'd need more. We never had that conversation that you, how long it would be or whatever. I didn't necessarily know it was going to be 5 months, but I knew it wasn't going to be one treatment, and that I just knew that, okay, you don't know. You have this vision in your mind of what you see on TV of chemo and people being sick all the time and like, you know, having horrendous experience of, like, you know, they're basically their head down a toilet and they're a horrible colour and all that sort of stuff. But the reality of it is quite different. That's the vision I had as I cried. We've got that ahead of us. But when you actually then went into the, you know, the beacon in the end, and they talked to you about how they would manage you, you're quite reassured by, they will find something that'll make you well and you'll be able to function, and you might be tired, but you'll still be able to do all these things. That I didn't know anything about. I just thought 3 months of chemo, you're going to be in bed for 3 months and you're going to be in bits. But I suppose it's different for everyone. And again, I don't know the types of chemo there are, but I'm sure that does happen for some people. But they had assured us for you that they would get it under control and you'd live as normal a functioning life as you were doing at that time through chemo.
When Dr. Morris said to us that my ovaries had an 80% chance of surviving the chemo, so there was 20% chance that I would be left infertile, I suppose. Like, there was a part of me that was like, I think I'll be fine. Like, I always trust my gut, and I think I would have taken the risk if it wasn't for you. I think you went full steam ahead with the IVF because I just couldn't take any more appointments, scans, statistics or anything like that. So you just went, and I said, Jamie, you just look after this IVF. I can't even read about it.
I just, you know, we'd had some pretty bad luck. So 80%, there's still a percent chance. Like, there's still a 20%. I just wasn't taking that risk. And like, Pia brought so much joy and positivity to our lives. And like, we were, you know, but like, I love being a dad, and I loved, you know, that first 6 months with Pia without any worry or any concern or anything like that. Like, I'm so proud of her, and like all I do all day is post pictures of her on my Instagram, proud dad. But there was no way I was taking a risk. So yeah, I was like, right, we're doing this, doesn't matter what it costs, you know. I'm going to pay for it, and we're going to expedite it as quick as we can and get it done, because we knew we had this kind of tiny window.
We had amazing support around us at that time, like Professor Owen O'Brien, who's a family friend, and he was consulting with my doctors and taking me through everything and really reassuring us. But the IVF itself, I'll never forget three of my best mates in work, Neil McDermott, Andy Mackin, and Carol. They bought me this advent calendar. I don't know why, because it was November. I don't know what happened, but they bought me a pair of UGG slippers and an advent calendar. And it was a rituals one, and I'd put it up. I was so excited because it was one of those beauty ones. And then when I started the IVF, I was like, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to open one of these windows every night after doing my injections. So you'd like line them all up, and then I'd have the advent calendar on the other side.
Oh my God, I forgot about that. Yeah.
And it really helped.
Yeah, I remember just unboxing the needles every night. And, you know, for anyone who doesn't know anything about IVF, you have to sort of crank up your dose yourself. So I think it's like 5 milligrams, 10, 15, 20, whatever your doctor prescribes you. So I would line them all up, line up the three needles, line up the three needles there. And then you'd do them. In fairness, you did them yourself, and I thought you'd be worse with them, but you weren't as bad. You'd do them all yourself into your stomach and different places in your leg, I think, as well. And then open your calendar, and that was that done. But we had this little ritual. Yeah, that really kind of took the sting out of it, excuse the pun, of actually just doing it and forgetting about it. It gave you something to kind of look forward to, a little win, I guess you'd call it, at the end of sticking a needle in yourself three times.
It was so good though that day when they rang us and said that 15 of our embryos fertilized.
I don't really remember that time. I just remember doing the IVF and then telling us it had been, you know, because we had already naturally conceived, that our chances of it being successful are quite high. But we only had this tiny little window that, you know, there was a 4 week window, I think. And I think you've talked about this before, but it's a 4 week window of where we had to get this done, because you were starting chemo in 4 weeks and the cycle takes 4 weeks. So we were like down to the wire. And I remember being a bit panicked about that. And I just remember your stomach being really swollen. And that was obviously the eggs. And then telling us then that they'd managed to recover 28 eggs, which is apparently quite big. I remember, well, that is the first win in this entire process. And those are the things that we need to focus on, is like, now it's going our way. Now the tables have turned. It hadn't spread to your lymph nodes was the first win. And the second win was the fact that we had had such a successful egg recovery.
Yeah, I think it was just such a relief when the IVF worked out. And then we were on to the chemo like 3 days later. Yeah. And I think we went into the oncology unit that day, like you just feel like it's your first day of school, like not knowing what to expect, not knowing where to sit or where to get an extra chair. And it's just all so nerve wracking. And then you're just kind of looking around. Were you shocked at the other people sitting on chairs, that they just looked so normal?
Yeah, yeah, there was definitely, and there was way more younger people there than I expected there to be. And that's just my own stupidity. And I remember just being, yeah, it's exactly like your first day at school. You're nervous. You don't know where to sit. You don't know the process of the systems and how things work. And I remember you went through it and you said you felt fine and, you know, you felt good and you wanted to go home. And I was like, I'll come home with you. And you being you were like, no, go back to work. You know, you should go in there. You've been out a good bit. So I was like, yeah, no, we just started, you know, the business. So I kind of felt like I should, you know, support Emmett as well and go back in. And I'm back in for a few hours, got a phone call from your mum saying you're great, everything's good. And then on the way home in the car, getting another phone call from your mum, and I was like, oh, something's happened. And her saying that you were in bits at that stage. And I think probably the steroids had worn off and that you were, you know, felt really sick. And I remember walking in the door and you were on the couch, turning right as I came in into our lounge, and like you were on the couch and you were that candle waxy colour. And I remember going, oh, this is the start of this now. I had hoped that because it, you know, that it had gone so well earlier that, you know, it wouldn't affect you in that way. But that was my own, I guess, naivety. And then what I remember about the rest of that night is eating, having dinner. You wouldn't eat. You just felt rotten. And then putting Pia to bed. And you doing your usual thing of being selfless, sending your mum home and then deciding you wanted to sleep in the spare room because you didn't want to disturb Pia or me in the night, and insisting on that. And I remember being a bit funny about that, but you were like, no, I'll be fine. It'll wear off. It'll wear off. And then it just didn't wear off. And I remember going in and out to you till about 11 o'clock until you were that bad. And I just was like, this isn't, I need to ring your mum to get Pia up, to get her up here to mind Pia. I remember just picking you up basically like onto my shoulder almost and putting you in the car and just,
I remember you
absolutely baiting it down to the beacon.
I remember being like, number one, I'm not in labour. Number two, I'm not about to die. Like, slow down. And then we went in and they brought me up to the beacon into a room and they were trying to get a vein, remember?
Mm.
And the nurse was like, she's as dry as a bone.
Yeah.
And
they couldn't. And the only position that you were kind of comfortable in was like on your knees on the bed. And I think this stage it was like 2:30 in the morning on the 19th of December. And like, I just remember thinking, well, jingle bells, this will be great Christmas. You know, you're going to be in here. How long are you going to be in here? And, you know, are they going to be able to get you out for Christmas? At that stage, like, that was our first Christmas with Pia, like, and
I don't even think we had a Christmas present bought.
No, I don't think any of that stuff happened, and it didn't feel like Christmas. It just felt like nothing, really. It felt like there was some sort of an event coming up, but not like Christmas Day, because we've always been all about Christmas. And like,
no, you have.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. But I've always been big into that. And I always wanted to make, you know, that time of, you know, that was our first Christmas in our new house with our new baby. And I always had it visioned in my head, it being this big thing with, you know, loads of presents, lights, and, you know, over the top Clark Griswold stuff going on. But it just wasn't, and to be honest, that doesn't really matter. But yeah, I remember thinking how sick you were and just praying that like they'd find the right medication. And I remember them ringing me in the morning saying that you're good, that you've settled and that you could be out in a couple of days. And I remember just thinking, I think you got out on the 22nd or something like that. You were in there for a few days until they got your bloods right. And I remember just get her out before Christmas.
We'll get back to the conversation right away, but I just wanted to take a minute to give you an update on my Fitbit experience. I've been wearing the newly launched Fitbit Versa 2 over the last month, and not only does it have even more health and fitness tracking features, it has 5 days of battery life and a new always-on display. I monitor my sleep every night and get a sleep score every morning. This is actually making me go to bed earlier because I found out that I'm not getting as much sleep as I thought I was. Alexa has come to Fitbit so I can find out the weather forecast, set timers and reminders, all by talking into my wrist. Oh, and the best thing of all, Fitbit Pay. I can now leave my wallet at home and tap to pay for things from my wrist. Really handy when you want to grab a coffee after a workout. Fitbit is really helping me keep on top of my healthy habits. Now, back to our conversation. Then we were into the first week in January and shaving their head. And like, how did you expect me? Did you expect me to be very upset that night?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be... I wasn't into the idea when you put it forward at first. I kind of thought that you should maybe do it in private, that it might be really upsetting for you. But then you had this idea in your head, and then the more...
So the idea was the Gypsy Kings, yeah. Glasses yeah. of red wine, candles.
Yeah, and if you think about it, you know, those are obviously, you know, that they're your... That's your happy feeling, listening to that music and having your friends around and candles and all that sort of stuff. So obviously you were just probably subconsciously leaning towards that, as opposed to sitting in a dark room with someone you don't know shaving your head. Mm. And that was the right thing to do. I just couldn't see that myself. But when I look back on it, it was absolutely the right thing to do. And it was really positive. And I remember the energy that night. And I remember just, it was almost like a party. It was like really positive energy. And the worst part of it was when everyone actually left and went home. And it was over. It wasn't that like I was like, oh my God, that's done now. It was actually just like the party had ended.
Mm. I think Danielle Garner, my hairdresser, made it because she cut my hair to different lengths on the way yeah. up to the shaved head
yeah.
and said, like, in August you'll look like this and yeah. next Christmas you'll look like this. And that just really helped me go, yeah. okay, like, life won't be so bad with really short hair.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, I think anyone, my advice to anyone that's doing that, don't just pick up the razor, shave your head, get someone to cut it into different lengths like you're talking about, and it gives you just, it gives you light at that, at the end of the tunnel. And that night was really positive, and I remember just everyone taking photos of you. The one thing I remember is when she actually did shave your head, I remember thinking to myself, your head is so small. I never, because you always had really big hair and you always backcombed it, and like your head was tiny, and like you're tiny, but I never thought about the size of your head before. So I remember just looking at your head for ages going, whoa, your head is like a pea.
The thing that I found hard though was, like, that night it was great because it was the shaved look and it was nice, but then when it all falls out and your eyelashes and your and your eyebrows go. And I remember, like, I'd lie in bed, and we have a huge Super King bed, and I remember one day being like completely bald, not a hair on my body, and I knew you were awake, and I was lying there wondering if you were staring up the back of my head. Mm. Like, just, you just feel so exposed and so...
Yeah, but for me, there was nothing... I never did that. I just said, like, this is the new look now. And you don't notice that shift from actually just having a shaved head where it's kind of stubbly and still having eyebrows to having nothing, because it's quite gradual, it's not sudden. Mm. So I got stage one got used to you having a shaved head, and then over it was a good few weeks before your hair and your head fell out before your eyebrows did.
Yeah.
So you still had your eyebrows and you were wearing your wig, so you still looked really normal. Not that you ever didn't look normal, but you didn't look too sick. And then your eyebrows did fall out, and you had a few little wispy ones still left. But at that stage, I had just got used to the new you.
The chemo was obviously, like, it took 5 months. It was a long 5 months. It was in the depths of winter. Like, how did you get through it? Because I was just in bed a lot.
Yeah. That for me was, it was weird. It was kind of lonely, because what happened for me there was that obviously we had just had Pia. And at that point, I sort of decided, right, I've got a job here and you've got a job. And we need to be super focused on what we need to get done in the next 25 weeks. So your job is stay healthy. Get through the chemo as quick as possible. So my sole focus was literally making sure you were healthy. You were doing everything you could to get your bloods right and get chemo every single week, because I didn't need you taking a knock of missing it by a week and then worrying if that's going to impact you, or missing it by 2 weeks. So I know you've said it before, but like, I was like, just do your job. and I'll do mine. And for me, my job was then literally everything else. So most things in my life just, you know, and in hindsight, I shouldn't have probably done this, but like everything went, like the gym, I play hockey, so hockey got dropped. You know, my sole focus was just making sure that Pia didn't wake you up in the middle of the night, because you're still jumping up and down if Pia, you know, screamed or dropped her dodie or whatever. I just went, I need to sit here. And every night I just sat on the couch from like 8 o'clock when you went to bed to like midnight, by myself, making sure that if Pia woke up, that I would peg it down the corridor or down our hall into her room to stop her crying, so that she didn't wake you up, so that you'd have a restful night.
I think for a lot of people who are supporting someone that's going through an illness will really recognise that loneliness, and it's a terrible time for the partner of someone, because at least a sick person is completely consumed with tiredness and they're just in bed sleeping, but the other person is just sitting there.
Yeah, and for me, it was sitting there and, you know, you're tempted to start reading stuff and, you know, like you can get spooked by that. But and that's what I did. I sat on the couch. I just was determined to understand this disease as much as I could, because, you know, I knew you would have speed wobbles, and I knew I needed to have answers for those speed wobbles, and back them up with actual medical facts as opposed to, you know, anecdotal stuff. So I spend a lot of time reading like websites and stuff, and Google is, you need to know how to navigate Google properly to do it. And I, at the start, was reading horror stories and stuff, and then I was comparing them to other stories and going, well, that's not factual and that's not right. So then what I ended up spending my time doing at night was actually reading, eventually finding like medical papers on breast cancer and actual published documents on research, from, you know, the Mayo Clinic and places like that, that were, you know, solid, robust stats, so that when you had your speed wobble, or when you sort of, you know, fell off the rails a bit and got worried or were crying or concerned, that I had the right info to back it up and bring it back to the practical, you know, things. I just remember always going to, remember the facts.
That really helped. And did you feel supported by people during this time? Because obviously everyone comes up to you and is like, how's Georgie all the time. Did you feel like obviously we have an amazing family, both sides of our family are great, and everyone was in our house all the time, so we were supported that way. But did you personally feel?
Yeah, definitely. There was, I mean, like, from our family were amazing. They all sort of assumed their roles. Eventually it sort of filters or percolates down, and, you know, your mum has her role, or my mum has her role, and Julie has her role, and, you know, Michael and Sam, and everyone had their little, and, you know, Joe, and everyone had their roles within that and helping us get through it. I did feel hugely supported by them and by anyone else. Like, the first question when anyone asked was always like, how's Georgie? And then the next question was, how are you?
And was that important to you that people asked?
Yeah,
you
hugely, because it didn't happen a few times. And obviously, like, that's fine. Like, and no one's thinking really, when the first thing they see is me, they're not thinking about, oh, how are you? They're thinking about, first question I need to ask is, how's Georgie? And then I talk about you, and then maybe we'll go off somewhere else. But it is really important to ask the partner how they're doing, because it actually gave me a massive boost when people were like, oh, they're thinking about me as well in this. Because, yeah, it just made me feel like, all right, so they're actually thinking about us, not, you know, and there's concern for me there as well, you know, which is really nice.
Around the time then when I started to share the story and people started following what we were going through, like, were you like surprised by the level of support from strangers?
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, a good few people reached out to me on Instagram and stuff like that, and were like, your wife's amazing. And, you know, then I see all the support that you are getting. And that comes back to, you know, the power of human connection, which you talk about a lot. It's so, so, so powerful. And it gives you like a massive release of endorphins when someone, you know, just randomly reaches out to you and says, "Whoa, your wife's amazing, and you guys are amazing, and what you're doing is amazing." And it makes the decision to go and do that all worth it. Because we debated that for a while, whether you were going to talk about it, and I felt like you should, and you kind of felt like you should as well, and we just didn't know if it was the right thing to do. But you wanted to raise awareness and drive, you know, as much awareness around, you know, breast cancer and checking yourself and that sort of stuff. So I think when you get the feedback, start to get the feedback saying this is incredible, and, you know, it just makes it all worthwhile.
Jenny Westrup sat me down around that time and said that I needed to exercise in my recovery. And we always kind of joked about it before I got sick that I was just the type of person who didn't exercise. Mm. And like, I used to go to yoga and stuff, but I'd never go to the gym.
Yeah, you wouldn't do cardio or anything like that, or go to the gym.
Were you surprised then that I took that on?
You being you, like, you're one of the most determined person I know. So you were determined once you heard about the exercise and the percentages and stuff like that, and the stats around exercise and how it, you know, helps. You were just like, right, I'm doing that. In the same way that you were ensuring that you were doing the right juicing to make help your bloods recover from the chemo and all that sort of stuff, you just took every single step. So it surprised me that you wanted to exercise, but it didn't surprise me that you wanted to exercise for that reason, because you never wanted to really do that stuff before. And for me, that's been like, we were always, so I was always the kind of sporty one, maybe not laterally, you know, in later years, but when we first met, I was very sporty and playing a lot of hockey and going to the gym and running and doing all that sort of stuff. But that was never anything we had together. And then when you said you wanted to do running, I was like, right, great. Let's do, like, you know, we talked about doing the park runs and getting fit that way and using those 5Ks. And, you know, I don't know how that came up, but I was like, right, this is something we can do together as a family. I'll push P in the buggy, you run along beside us. And because, you know,
I have to say, though, getting out on a Saturday morning and instead of like lounging around the house in your PJs with the telly on, it was so positive for us as a family to get out and do those park runs. And it really, I think it really shifts you into weekend mode and makes you detach from your phone. And two, we used to go for breakfast every Saturday straight after the park run and just have that family time together. It's like my favorite memories of us.
It's that I loved those days, and they're like, obviously with, you know, the winter coming in now, we're going to go back to doing those. They're hugely important, but it also comes back to the power of human connection, I think, as well. There's a kind of community there that does those. So you see the same faces every week if you do the same run every week, and you know, you're like, there's that guy, I'm going to beat him next week.
Jamie, you're not
No, but it's determination, and everyone drives each other on. I'm sure people are looking at me going, I'm going to beat that guy next week. So it's, you know, and everyone encourages each other and all that sort of stuff. So there's a hugely positive spirit around that whole thing. And that only goes, again, to help, you know, release the endorphins and make people happy and all that sort of stuff. So, I look forward to going back to that.
The Great Pink Run, we're doing it. Dublin next Saturday, the 19th of October in the Phoenix Park. Professor Arnie Hill is the chairman of Breast Cancer Ireland. Obviously, Breast Cancer Ireland, Sam and Ashley, they're like my family, and all the girls. Going to Chicago to do the Great Pink Run was such an insanely amazing, positive thing to do for our family. And it was, the whole experience gave us so much. Even though, like, it's obviously, just for anyone listening, like, our life isn't perfect. Like, myself and Jamie, we have our arguments. The last 2 years has not been easy on our relationship, but going to Chicago to run 10K together was pretty nice.
Ah, yeah, that was a big life milestone, I suppose, for us both. And I was only looking back on all the photos and you know, all the stuff last night. Like, we did so much in so short a period of time, but everything is like a really positive memory. The run itself for me was like, I love running in other cities and doing that sort of stuff and just looking around and absorbing, you know, the energy in the city and the vibe and running with all these other amazing people who have had breast cancer or who have had some sort of cancer or who are supporting their friends who are going through treatment or something like that is an incredible experience and one that's life changing and will, you know, stay with me for my life. It's a big life milestone, I think, for me anyway.
We crossed the finish line together holding hands, but do you think we will next Saturday? I think you're going to run off on me and beat your PB.
I need to get my PB, so I might just wait for you at the line and then run back and pretend we did it together.
You never know, I could beat you next Saturday. No, it was incredible, and I just think it's such a positive thing to do, and I hope people come out and join us next Saturday. Is there anything that you would say to anyone who's starting out on this journey, who is supporting someone who is going through a tough time?
Yeah, well, I think for me, what worked for me might or may not work for other people. Like, but my advice would be that in the journey, you need to just set out milestones. Obviously, look to the end goal and go, look, when is this going to be over and when are we going to get better? And never in my mind was if you were never not going to get better. Like, I just knew that everything was going to be fine. We just needed to get through the process. And in my head, then I just set key milestones out. So, like, obviously, the first one was, okay, we've got surgery. The next one was IVF. The next one was the start of chemo. The next one was the head shave. And then there was a few that was like in my head, I was like, okay, well, what am I going to do the first night she's sick or if she's continued to be sick? So I kind of in my mind, and I remember writing it down. I don't know where the pad has gone that I wrote stuff down, but I kind of formulated a weird little plan to myself. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. If this happens, this is what I'm going to do. So I ran through, and that was what I was doing on those kind of lonely nights on the couch, was sort of formulating plans and saying, well, if this happens or this scenario happens, this is what I'm going to do. And this is what I'm going to, and it's just, that's just.
I just thought you were watching Suits.
Yeah, well, I did do a Suits marathon, but that was when I eventually switched off. But I used to honestly spend a lot of time coming up with plans and trying to understand the disease, learn about it, be able to answer your questions when you had them, but also formulate plans around the milestones. You know, if the road turns this way, this is what we're going to do. If the road turns that way, this is what we're going to do.
Was there a moment that you felt like it was over and things were back to normal? Like, I don't think I've had that moment yet. Like, I'm just, it's just the new normal. But has there been a moment for you that you've been like, it's over?
No, not really. Because there is no back to normal, like you said. It's just a new normal. It's a new way of being and a new way of living.
But do you prefer our new life?
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Look at everything that we've got to do together and the experiences that Pia has had and that your mum and my mum and our family and Michael and Kira and Joe, everyone has had. Like, they've been on that journey with us and it's been really negative. But the positive side of it way outweighs the negative side. So the impact that it's had on our lives has altogether, sum it all up, been really positive. And therefore, you know, I think it's made our family closer and we've had all these amazing experiences, which is only a good thing.
And you came up with the name The Good Glow.
Are you crediting me with that finally?
I might cut this bit out.
Yes.
But I did want the word glow to be in it, and you said The Good Glow, so thank you for that. And one last question. Do you see us going on to have another baby?
Yeah, of course I do. Like, that's all that I want is like happy family and I can't wait for that to happen. Of course it's going to happen. Like, you know, and ever since things hit rock bottom that day, you know, when your cancer was confirmed and all that, it's only been positive wins since then. Look back at all the wins. There's been the really good egg thing, the fact that you smashed the chemo and did it in 24 weeks of 23 possible ones, and you know, your blood's been good, you're getting through radio, not being sick throughout the whole of chemo, everything has been hugely positive. So, you know, for us both, like, you know, I just think having another baby whenever that time comes, because it can't be now and it can't be next year, will be huge. And I can't wait for Pia to have a brother or sister.
Well, thanks for all the support over the last I don't know what to say. Normally I thank people for coming in, so I think I'll just say that we've gotten through it together. I couldn't have done it without you, and thank you so much for every single ounce of support and love that you've given me and Pia and all of us over the last 2 years.
Thank you. And but like, I don't know what else I would have done. Like, it's not like, you know,
why I married you.
Once it all happened, it was laser focused. Let's get this done. Let's get through it and move on with our new life. And I said it in our speech at our wedding, that your determination is only rivaled by mine. It's actually bigger than mine. And I think your determination to get through this and make it positive and make an impact on other people's lives and make really impactful change has been huge.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast with thanks to Fitbit. If you're enjoying this podcast, please hit the subscribe button and leave a review. For more on my story, you can follow me on Instagram at georgie.crawford.